Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Seven former Ohio State students last week described their alleged abuse at the hands of a former university physician, Richard Strauss, in testimony before the OSU Board of Trustees. It marked the first time the Board of Trustees heard directly and publicly from victims in this case. We're talking about that and other OSU news today with Ohio State University President Dr. Michael Drake. Welcome back.
Always good to be here, Ann.
You were also at that hearing. The investigators told trustees at the same hearing that dozens of former students have reported consistent descriptions of abuse. Some 150 former students have accused Richard Strauss of sexual abuse. Where does this case stand now? This was a kind of a benchmark moment.
Well, let me see. I remember when I first heard of it, which was April, the day of the board meeting in April, unrelated to the board meeting, these issues were brought forward, and I would have heard about it that morning about 9 or 10, and that afternoon at 1 o'clock we had a press release to announce it broadly, and then throughout the spring we sent out a series of requests for people who might have any information on these issues to bring them forward. We worked through the Attorney General and were able to bring on an independent investigatory law firm. We look really for the strongest people in the country to help bring in, to help do these investigations. We have a very strong firm in Perkins Coie. In fact, they advise the FBI and the CIA, and so they're really Marcus Funk, the partner who does this, really is a national expert. And we began hearing from, they began hearing from alumni who'd been students during those years right away in April. And at first a few, and then a few more, and then a few more. And then you remember over the summer that some of them put together videos and other things that they shared with us and were shared nationally. And there was quite a bit of national news about people who, in addition to those who were the survivors of this, there were those who were in the milieu who they said must have known about it. One congressman was mentioned a lot. So that was really big news in June and July. And but all through that time, the investigation was continuing. In the spring, I think I sent out about 250,000 emails. We contacted all of the current students and faculty. We contacted all the alumni that we could find from that era. We sent an email to sent an email to all student athletes who had attended during that time and didn't graduate because the alumni list wouldn't have them. And and the idea that our request all along was that people who had information could share it with the independent investigators so we can find out what happened and then respond appropriately. So that's where we are. This last week's visit to the Board of Trustees meeting by the individual who came forward, they gave a request to the board about a week and a half or so ago, roughly, and the board granted that request, and we welcomed them to the meeting to share their stories with us and appreciate them coming forward. I will say, and so I've been, of course, following this or in receiving reports from the independent investigators since the very beginning, but it takes extraordinary courage to come forward and to share these stories, and we really appreciate the fact that they were able to do that. And as I said, we look forward to a resolution.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Excuse me. My guest is OSU President Dr. Michael Drake. We're talking about the latest in the investigation into allegations of abuse by a former Ohio State physician, Richard Strauss. He's now deceased. He committed suicide in 2005 after 7 years of retirement. A lot of the accusers, Dr. Drake, are angry with Ohio State and how it handled the investigations at the outset when people complained years ago about Dr. Strauss. They say they were ignored. And obviously it predates you. It's not, the onus isn't necessarily on you. But how does the university respond now to what wasn't done years ago?
Well, I'd say first, when the stories that we've heard, the accounts we've heard all along, and the ones we heard last week were really of horrible things to hear. They're incredibly distressing, and so we want to be appropriately supportive. I would say that how things, there were two parts to the independent investigation. One was what happened, and the second is what did university officials at the time know, and how did they respond? And so that's really the information that we're gathering. And I certainly hear, we heard the stories last week that of things that were and weren't done, and that's a part of the investigation so that we can look at those and then and do our very best to respond appropriately. What I will say, and I make this point clear, we take this extraordinarily seriously. As I said, these are horrible stories, and we will not in any way dismiss these individuals.
You know, we talked about this last time, but it's probably worth mentioning again, just between the Strauss case, the Larry Nassar case at my, you know, alma mater, Michigan yes. State, the Jerry Sandusky case out of Penn State, what happened at Maryland University with their head football coach being fired after a player died from exhaustion and heat stroke over the summer. How is higher education taking a closer look at its priorities? I mean, all of these things have to do with sports, and that is not a core mission of any of these universities, supposedly.
I say all the time, I say it routinely, that we are extraordinarily concerned with the welfare of our students, and we have to be. We take it as a primary responsibility. And it's hard for me to say, to talk about other people or at about other times. How are things 20 and 30 and 40 years ago? I don't have much. We don't have much control over that. I could say that here at this university, we do our very best to take seriously the health and safety of our students, and every day, all day, are trying to do the best we can to help give them the maximum opportunity to have productive, positive lives. And there are a lot of things to manage, and we do our very best to take care of our students and make our programs the best they can be.
But is this a conversation that other, you know, I know that you're talking with other administrators, yes. other university presidents across the country. What do you learn from this? What are they talking about?
Yeah, I think all of us try to look at circumstances, things that don't work well. And let me say again that the cases that you've mentioned are horrible cases, really.
And there's more out there.
And so I guess the thing that I take from this is that there must be more out there, because yeah. when you and I heard it the first time, we were, oh, my goodness, that's awful. What an awful thing. And then it happens again someplace else. And we said, oh, my goodness, that's awful. And then another time and another time. And so we really do want to take a step back and think about what's going, what could lead to this. And we hope that our current the current things that are the checks and balances that we have in place now are better. I don't know that they're perfect, but we hope that they're better than they would have been 5 and 10 and 20, in our case, 30 and 40 years ago with the case that came up last week. Mm-hmm. But it's really a continual effort. And part of what we want to learn from the investigation are things that lessons that we can learn from the past that might be useful. And I think we want to share these broadly. When we get together in groups of us, we talk about things that we can all learn to help us do a better job. No one, everyone is horrified by these circumstances and wants to do what I would certainly speak for ourselves. We really want to do what we can to protect our students and make things safe. And that's our entire focus.
through mid-August, Ohio State had spent about $1.5 million on this investigation. is the tab up significantly? And what is it now, I guess? And why does it cost so much money?
Yeah, I don't actually wouldn't have seen the most recent tabs. The in this current investigation is looking at a period roughly of 20 years from the late 1970s to the late 1990s. There are thousands and thousands of documents to be reviewed. As you mentioned, 150 former students have come forward with accounts of abuse, and another 300 or so have come forward with other information. They weren't themselves survivors. They were the witnesses to one or another thing. And so there have been over 400 people interviewed. And it takes time to interview each of those people. It takes time to go through the documents. we wanted to get a nationally prominent and significant firm to do it. One, so that it wouldn't in any way look like we were doing it. We our interest is in finding out what's true, period. And we wanted to make sure that someone else is doing that for us and then reporting it back to us. So it's an entirely independent investigation. But we also then wanted to get somebody who was the best that they could be. And these law firms and others who do this work are expensive, and that the tabs become relatively high. But the most important thing for us is to get to the truth.
How the resolution of the issue of the assistant football coach at Ohio State what happened and how the university responded and dealt with the head coach and how he handled the allegations. What are your thoughts, your takeaways from that at this point?
Well, one is that we spent a lot of time on this this summer, and we had an investigation to look at the data we had, and we found that there were some management lapses, not in relation to the allegations that came out this summer, but things over time that could have been managed better. And so we arranged what we believe was, based on the investigation, we arranged appropriate remedy to that. Those were suspensions that were served now months ago, and mm-hmm. let me say that that's now all in the past, and we're looking forward to we have important work to
There's
do today
a game
looking
this
forward
week.
Game this week, for instance.
Yeah. Well,
and the idea for that was really to take that, to handle it. We did our best with great intensity to handle it in August and September, and we're moving on.
But next year's another payday, and Urban Meyer was suspended for three games this year. You signed off on it.
Yes.
I know you're going to say that you're okay with it. So I'm not even going to ask, because what else can you say?
Yeah.
But what about that going forward? I mean, is this a point that on which you hang your hat and say, no, you're not getting a bonus this year? We spent a lot of time and money dealing with this mess over the summer. You didn't earn it.
What did you say you knew I was going to say? You said I was going to say that we...
You were happy with the resolution and how things were handled.
Yeah, this was hard work,
yes.
I will say. And
right.
I took it extraordinarily seriously, and we wanted to have a fair, considered, balanced outcome. And I believe we got there. This is one where, when these kinds of circumstances, when you get a fair, considered, balanced outcome, people on one side are unhappy. People on the other side are unhappy. In this case, that they're about half and half.
That's how I do my job, too.
So that's really what we worked really hard to do. Very not pleasant for anyone. And what we want to do is say that was done. That's we're now in the future. Let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
We have work to do. Let's go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take a break here. We will continue our conversation. My guest is Ohio State University President Dr. Michael Drake. More to talk about, of course. It's Ohio State University, and there's always something happening here. So if you have a question or comment for Dr. Drake, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can check out our Facebook page as well. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest is OSU President Dr. Michael Drake. We're talking about this and that, sundry things. We just concluded a conversation about the issue of the Dr. Richard Strauss, who has been now deceased, who's been accused by 150 people so far of sexual assault when he was working at Ohio State University. Now we're headlong into, it's already Tuesday of rivalry week, as you'd like to call it, but some people refer to it as hate week, this intense rivalry between Ohio State and Michigan. And there's a couple questions I want to ask you about that.
That's why we're here, Ann. So.
What about this whole idea of hate week? It was referenced in letter to the editor today in the Columbus Dispatch. And the person who wrote the letter was struggling with that and how much animosity there is and how much vitriol there can be over this a game. How do you feel about that in this day and age of even using a phrase like hate week?
So I actually probably wouldn't use such a phrase. You know, we have a rivalry game against the school from the state up north. It's rated by different things that rate such things. I guess there are people who do this for a living, but as the top rivalry in college sports and one of the top rivalries of any kind of athletic competition in the country. And so there's a great deal of energy. You know, to be able to have a real rival, you have to have respect for your opponent. And we've been in this for well over almost 150 years of our as universities, and then over 100 years as in competition. So we work, in fact, as you know, with the school up north on a variety of things, 364 days a year. I guess we also have other competitions with them and other sports besides football. Mm-hmm. But we have multiple collaborations with them as we do with other universities. And this just happens to be the most intense and high-energy rivalry in college sports. I've had a few pleasures. One, I happen to be, we'll give an award this week. We announce the President's Prize winners, which are two graduating seniors who have engaged in a campus-wide competition that takes many months with faculty and students together to come up with who has the best ideas for changing the world in a positive way. And we have just selected and we'll announce the winners here. That's great. And they'll be introduced. I think actually they've been announced. They'll be introduced at the game. And so I have the opportunity to be on the sidelines as the game's about to start. And the energy in the air is something that is unlike anything else you ever experience. It's almost though you could pick up a molecule of air and lift it, and everybody in the stadium would be lifted because everybody's so intensely connected. So it's an incredible feeling, and you know we're looking forward to a great result.
There's a in concert with your refusal to use the word Michigan.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're breaking up there.
Yeah. There's another tradition of putting duct tape over all the M's on the signs on campus, and someone would like to know if those can be taken off by April or maybe even as soon as March.
We could say about that, yes.
OSU Board of Trustees approved a 2019 football ticket price increase, but not for students, just all the rest of us out there. Why is that even necessary, given how much money the athletic department brings in by way of football?
So this price increase actually had a price decrease this past season. You didn't ask me about that when I came on, but you asked me.
Who does that?
Right. But so the prices went down last season. They're based on, and then this next season are going back up to about where they were in 2016. We started a few years ago having variable ticket prices. And the reason for doing that was to, and I'll say this slowly because we'll get some pushback, but the reason for doing that actually, so the most desirable games had the prices go up. But what that allowed us to do was to take the games that weren't as competitive and lower the prices to make it more affordable for families and others to be able to go, because the prices are expensive no matter what, and we're able to lower by 30-40% the games that maybe not as many people would want, the games that aren't quite as competitive. But that gives people who might not have a chance to come to the games a chance to get to a game or two, which we think is a very good thing. It averages out about the same. And we manage this really comes through athletics, of course, but the ticket prices are managed to try to handle the expenses of the broad program. And it's the football program, but also the other 34 or so sports we have that don't bring in revenues enough to support them. So we have a really expansive athletic program among the largest in the country, largest in the world for collegiate athletics. And it takes a lot of support for all those things to be maintained, and the popularity of football allows us to have revenue to do those things. We also have money that comes from the athletic program, in addition to the facilities and all those things this pays for. Money goes really back to the campus, and so we have internships and scholarships for people who are not in the athletic programs. We have money that goes to support the libraries, money that goes to support our University Institute for Teaching and Learning. So that goes broadly across the campus. So there's no, that money all goes back into supporting the things that are important to the campus. And I will say that the prices are below market. And you look right now and go online and say, gee, what's the ticket price for any of the games? And the prices on in the aftermarket are higher than the ones that are charged. Mm-hmm. The idea is to try to balance the revenue that comes in to the program so we can have the best program in the country, but to try to moderate the prices. We don't charge market rate. I don't like to talk about it much. I mean, I know it's expensive, and we really do appreciate that. And I'll just say, and you should have others beside me verify what I'm going to say, but when I hear about the prices, I ask the same questions that you're asking, and they have to justify why they are where they are, and it has to go to the board to be approved. And we want it to be as affordable as it can, understanding that a program like ours is a very expensive program.
Are you happy with the outcome of allowing beer to be sold?
When we looked at this, we first studied what the experience was at other places, and then we started in increments. We began with the suites, and then we moved to different parts of the stadium. What we found, and then we measured very carefully the crowd behavior, et cetera. And what we found, what was the case at other places, Minnesota, I believe, did this the year before we did, Maryland, about the same time as we did. When we looked at the experience in other stadiums, we found that when you sold the beer at the stadium, that you had fewer incidents than when you didn't. And when people were drinking to excess in the parking lot.
Binging, that kind of thing.
Binging in the parking lot, drinking all the, you know, in line. And then there's an incredible problem with smuggling. People wearing clothing to smuggle. And so we found that you actually, that the number of incidents drops substantially from the year before we did this until the year that we did it first, that we had fewer incidents in the stadium. So that was great. Like sometimes a third as few, half as few, three quarters fewer incidents. And then we also used the revenue from this to hire more security for the games, certainly. But we hired four full-time 24/7, 365 officers. So we increased the number of officers on our campus year-round with these revenues, and that was a part of the agreement to look at going forward. Could we make the stadium safer and have fewer incidents in the stadium? And it turned out that that was the case. Could we use revenue to make the campus safer by increasing the size of our campus force 24/7, 365? And we did that as well. And that was all part of this pilot program and then that we implemented.
One more question related to the game is Mirror Lake. It reopened this fall after a two-year $8.5 million renovation. Mostly it drains faster, right?
No. Real differences. So we had a $100 million project to renovate that district on campus,
Volvo.
Oxlane, Palmarine.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at those buildings, they're beautiful. They maintain things that were true about them in the 1920s, and the facades are similar, but they've grown. They're modern buildings, and in fact, we have very modern things like data analytics and then history of art all taking place in the same building. So it's a great way to use the facades of the buildings from 100 years ago but make it the modern university of today. That's great. The lake was also then restored to be more like it was 100 years ago. And instead of being with paved and other things that made it difficult, it was just not a good part of the water table. It's now a more natural part of water management. And there are plants that are growing. There'll be aquatic life that will come and live there. So it's a more natural, sustainable part of the campus. I hope that you're one of the many people who finds it a beautiful and iconic presence on campus. And so we wanted to change it out and to make it more like it was 100 years ago, to make it more sustainable, to make it more environmentally sensitive. And then, to be honest, I have been to the lake with a couple of families who have lost their children. One in particular case lost at the lake, another here on campus. So there were students who came here as freshmen were enthusiastic Buckeyes and then weren't able to graduate because they lost their lives. And I think of the of a beautiful, iconic, and quiet place as kind of a remembrance for all those Buckeyes that we lose along the way. And so I think it has a real presence for us, and that it needs to be respected. Because the size of our student population, the saddest part of my work is that I hear every time we lose a student, and when we can, which is almost all the time, we talk to the parents, and then on occasion we visit with them as well, and it's the saddest part of what we do. And the lake is a kind of a place to remember those students, and you know that all they really want, if they could pray for what they would get, it would be actually to be there and seeing what we're seeing when we look at it. So I think of it as a very special place on campus.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Ohio State University President Dr. Michael Drake. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Three counselor positions were added in the University Counseling and Consultation Service, and a report by the staff of the Lantern found that the office still fails to meet the standards that are set by the International Association of Counseling Services. That's a accreditation association for higher ed. It recommends one professional to every 1,000 to 1,500 students. And Ohio's ratio is more like 1 to 1,600 or more than 1,600 students. I know that they've added three counselor positions, but it still falls short.
Well, I don't know. So a couple of things I'd say. First is that I understand those recommended ranges, and I know that counselors have been added since that study was done last spring. So I couldn't tell you what the ratio is now. What I would say is that we take very seriously the support. I mentioned earlier we care about the health and safety of our students, mm-hmm. and some people say, "Gosh, is that it true?" It's completely true. It's really what we want to be the case, and so we have those counseling services. We also have things though that other campuses don't, and that is that we have, for instance, a full service hospital on campus. That's not routine. We have a mental hospital on campus. That's very, very rare. So we have services that are available in addition to the counseling services that really run the range of all those things that are available any place in the country. And we try through all those services to be as supportive and nurturing a campus as we can. I will say that we put together a mental health task force last spring, mm-hmm. to review. And the question there was, what are we doing? What is the best possible practice? What can we do to move forward in that way? And that group came back with recommendations at the end of the summer. In fact, they just presented an update to the board last week. After the task force, we appointed another group that is the implementation force to make sure that the recommendations don't just sit on a shelf but are put into action. And they're working actively now to continually do what we can to improve the quality of support services we had. I'll say when I arrived, we had about 30 personnel doing this work. Mm-hmm. Before any of this was in the news, I looked at that number and said, I think we can do a little bit more. And working with Student Life, we increased from 30 to 45. That was done in 2015 and 2016, so a few years ago. That helped with our ratios. We found, though, that even though we had increased the ratios, that the demand was increasing at a faster rate. And so we actually then re-looked at things again this spring and have the recommendations before us now. And it's something that we'll continually work on. It's an issue for us at the university, but also across the state and across the nation.
What do you make of this increased demand? That's a real thing, and it's happening across the country.
Yes, it's a real thing that's happening across the country, and I don't know that anyone is able to get out in front of it. I would say that first we all have stressful lives, and we are recognizing, and more people than ever are recognizing the value of having support and dealing with those times of stress. And my hope is, I was raised in a family where my father was a psychiatrist. I was raised in a family that looked at these things, and my hope is the stigma of dealing with these issues is being reduced, and more people are able to get help. But it's a national area of great concern, and we're working hard and contemporarily to try to, in a contemporary fashion, to try to keep up.
OSU closed its Sexual Civility and Empowerment Unit back in May and fired four employees after student complaints were supposedly ignored. When do we get a new name, and when is it going to reopen? And
yeah, so
what's going
things.
On? What's taking so long?
Yeah, a couple things. So a new name, you know, would be actually convenient for times like this when
yes,
you ask what the
have
name
to
is.
Say it.
Yes,
yeah,
yeah, we'll get a name. But this, so the that unit was an adjunct to all the other services that we provide and have always continued to provide, and other campuses don't have that adjunct to view. That was extra. And when we decided that that wasn't working well, those services remained. We just moved them to other units that we have, and we've then since hired even more people. So the services are still here. They're not in the concentration that was done in that particular unit last spring. What we've done is, starting in August, at the time that schools started, we opened a central unit with a place where students, faculty, and staff who have issues of sexual misconduct who've survived sexual assaults all can go to the same place. What we had was one way that students would have this addressed, another for faculty, another for staff. That was disjointed, wasn't working so well. And so one of the recommendations last spring was to bring those together into a centralized center. And that now opened in August. And so and that's been working well. We had a pair of complaints last winter from students. So it wasn't, given the number of these incidents we have on campus, there were a relatively small number of complaints. Yeah, but those led to us to take a look at how things were being handled and then to open up a new unit this summer, which has been working well from all reports I've gotten.
Are you confident that students understand these changes and know where to go to get help if they need it?
Yeah, I hope so. Certainly, we have done surveys. We actually spoke about this again yesterday. We did surveys in 2015 to look to see, did students understand where to go, or did they believe anything would be done if they went? And we got those responses back. We changed orientation to make sure that we let students know where to go. And we then have resurveyed since, and we found actually a significant increase in the percentage of students who say they know where to go. Most students now for sure say they know where to go, or it's easy to find. And then also we're pleased that most students believe that their complaints or their issues are taken very seriously by us and by everyone, and that's dramatically higher than it was 4 or 5 years ago. And so I think that's working well. The number of reports that we have has gone up, which is what we expect. That's the goal for us, and we want to continue to do all we can to encourage that. We have now mandatory training for students and faculty and staff. So we want to make it as easy and direct as possible for anyone who has a concern or an experience to share in this area to be able to come forward. And that's all that's in our interest in this case.
What are your thoughts about efforts by the Secretary of Education to change the Title IX standards for protections for people who are accused of sexual assault?
Make a comment about that. I'm also thinking that maybe we could talk about some of the good things that are happening on
campus.
I think that would help.
I want to
help your mental health, Anne, if you would talk about the other 99% of things that we do that are working historically well. But let me answer that.
Sorry.
My interest in for our all of our students, all of our faculty, all of our staff, is that they work in a safe place that values them and their experiences as people, and we do everything we can to support success. I want that for our students. I want that for you. I want that for all the people we have here. I know that there are new guidelines that are being suggested. They're now open for public comment. And
right.
I work with APLU, and APLU will have a statement. My concern is that some of the guidelines might make it more challenging for people to come forward, which I would believe would be in exactly the wrong direction. It's a separate and maybe a bit nuanced conversation, but I want to do what we can to encourage people to come forward to seek support, guidance, and help, and to help us respond appropriately to them. I'm worried that some of the guidelines make it more difficult or more challenging to come forward, and that's not our issue, is that not enough people are coming forward, not too many.
My guest is Ohio State President Dr. Michael Drake. We'll continue our conversation. We'll get to some calls, 614-292-8513, and the happy news. So stay with us.
Yes, the rest of it.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, Ohio State University President Dr. Michael Drake. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And let's just go to a call right now and kick it off with something different than me. Paul in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I live in the North Campus area. I'm a member of the University Area Commission. I am also a landlord up at the University of Minnesota, and I rent to police officers at a discount. Now, the university here, the Ohio State University, has a program to support home ownership by Ohio State University employees. I spoke to my city council member, Mike Stinziano, who was tried unsuccessfully to talk to Professor Drake and to ask him to tell the Ohio State University's police officers that there is a grant program, $15,000, to support home ownership in the university area. Why not have the Ohio State University Police Department tell its officers about this program so that they can buy homes in the university area? It would be good for everyone.
Okay. Well, Dr. Drake.
Yeah. So we established this program to, in fact, help people with home ownership in university areas. So that's the reason it's there. Second, you said Mike Stinziano, who I know well, tried to talk to me unsuccessfully. He's a friend of mine. I see him. He comes to games. We're neighbors. So Mike, I talk to Mike anytime. So there's no reason for Mike not to be able to talk to me yet. So I tried unsuccessfully to talk to me. That struck me as being I talk to Mike routinely.
Has he brought this up?
I haven't heard this from him, but it's a program that we established for the purpose of having people do this. So we're happy to have people do this.
Okay. All right, Paul, thanks for that call. That's interesting to know. 614-292-8513. You got a 2.5% raise, which is pretty much what all of us, you know, it's university
wide.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you also got a $212,000 bonus, and there are people. So I'm just wondering, and that's for doing good things over the past year. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you've done over the past year. A lot of it has to do with access to education for low income.
Yeah, so I'll just say that when we started, we created my package when I came in, said that my increases would be the same as the staff generally, and that 25% of that was variable and could be cut, or I would get it if things were okay and things worked out nicely. So that's
you're doing your job.
Well, we'll try. So a couple things that are going really going nicely for us this year. Our class that we just admitted turned out to be several things all time. That's the largest that we'd admitted. We have more students now on the Columbus campus, more students total, and more graduate students than we've ever had. But also the incoming freshman class, had the highest grades and test scores in our history, so the most talented class. And also we were more diverse than any of our classes in the past. And to be able to have our classes be more talented grades and test-wise, but also more diverse is something that we really cared about a lot. We've also been focused on creating more opportunity for low and moderate income students. As we were becoming more selective, that there's more pressure, and so we have to make sure that we maintain a pathway for low and moderate income students. And we increased about 7% the number of Pell Grant eligible students that we have on campus, so we're very pleased about that. And that's our original founding mission, is to be a place where the people from the region have access to, and that's excellent. And we believe that that's all moving forward. So we're very pleased about that. Our graduation rate is 6 years as high as it's ever been. Our graduation rate, the highest it's ever been. That's great. Our persistence rate, that is the number of first-year students that go on to the second year, at 94.5%. That's the highest it's ever been. You know, the old thing on the convocation where you say, look left, look right. Well, now if you look left and look right, 19 out of 20 students are going to be back next year. So it's a great thing. We care a lot about that. And we're working to do everything we can to make student success better. And we appreciate that. Some other things we've done, we've work to try to be more affordable. So we have the Buckeye Opportunity Program now, which says that if you are a Pell-eligible student, that's roughly the median income of the state or that group or below, that you come with the grant you get from your Pell Grant and other places, and then we will fill any gap between what those cover and the cost of tuition, so your effective tuition will be neutralized. And that's the case for the students on the Columbus campus now. It becomes the case for second semester students at the regional campuses starting in January. That's quite profound, and we're excited about that. And so we're able to do that, which is very, very important. We added another group of land grant opportunity scholarships, which are scholarships that are full tuition, room, and board. And we had a program to have that one for each county a few years ago, and actually that was down to, it was full tuition but just tuition, so we increased it from being just tuition to being now tuition, room, and board, one for each county. And then that program was so successful and popular, we doubled it, so now we have full tuition, room, and board, and that's at two for each county, so that's about 175 students a year. We're excited about that.
You know, the persistence numbers that you mentioned, how much do you think that's a function of now having sophomores living on campus, which was one of the goals of having sophomores on campus?
Great program. That sophomores living on campus was found to be in programs where sophomores live on campus, the living on campus was associated with better student success. Mm-hmm. We would think that that would mainly show itself in the second to third year persistence, but we would hope that there'd be an effect on first to second year as well, that students know where they're going to be when they come back. So all these things, this was started by my predecessor, and we appreciate that very much. And all of this is to make us a more nurturing, more supportive, more successful university. And we see that happening. It's really great.
Okay, here's some time for some controversy now. Will in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Will.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Dr. Drake, I'd like to know your comments or thoughts on the changes in the color of the uniforms here a while back. We had a game that the uniforms were black. I find that really aggravating. I don't like it. What can we do to change that?
So that's an interesting practice that happens at prominent teams throughout the country. And it's generally the equipment manufacturer with which you have a contract.
They had an extra bolt of black out there, and they thought,
For whatever reason, it's a kind of a fan excitement issue, and so they'll have a blackout game, or at Penn State they have a whiteout game, and it's meant to be a special feature with kind of and, you know, then the pros, they have throwback uniforms, so they'll wear a 1930s uniform, and it's meant to one game a year bring extra fan excitement. And I understand I understand your point and the tradition and what our uniforms look like normally. The players tend to really like it and find it to be an exciting thrill, and that's one of the reasons that we've gone supported it. So we'd like to give them a chance to have something special to do, and it's very popular with players. I do understand that many of our fans may not like it, so many others do, Ed. So let me hear your concern. I appreciate it, Ed. Want you to continue rooting for the Buckeyes, Ed, but I understand your concern.
You were sworn in last month as chair of the board of directors for the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
What do you do?
So we have two organizations, I guess. One is the Association of American Universities, which are the leading research universities in the country. It's the 62. And so I was chair of that group last year. And then I had a little hiatus of 3 weeks. And then I'm now very, very honored and flattered that my colleagues have asked me to take this position with the APLU. APLU's roughly 250 public and land grant universities from across the country. So your alma mater and many others are APLU members, public and land grant universities. And we do two things primarily. One is that we come together and discuss the issues like all the ones that you're bringing to me. We get together and talk about how we can do a better job of addressing those issues. And we really do talk about specifically these exact issues in a variety of groups. The president's talk, the provost's talk, the student affairs officer's talk. So the convention that we had last week would have had about 1,500 delegates from these universities and other support people. So it's a very large convention where we talk about the issues. Walter Isaacson was our keynote speaker this year. One keynote speaker, actually, Rebecca Blank, who's the Chancellor University of Wisconsin, gave another great speech. And then all of us get together and do sessions. I made a presentation. It was good fun. So we come together like any organization and talk about best practices in our sphere. The other thing that we do is the organization is headquartered in Washington, D.C., and they, on a daily basis, monitor policy and work to make sure that the universities in the country are represented with policymakers on an ongoing and regular basis. So I will I did this last year with the first group, and I will this coming year with this second group, meet every month or two with leading lawmakers or politicians and talk about things like the new proposed changes to Title IX regulations.
Hmm. Ohio State does have a lobbyist, though, in Washington, doesn't it?
Yes. So we have an office in Washington, as do other universities of our size. It's very important. And we have an office here. And so we are in contact with members of the legislative, executive, and executive branches on a daily basis on one issue or another all year long. And some of them are quite important. And with the national organizations, we deal with things like the implications in the last year's tax bill or in the higher education reauthorization bill or in proposed changes to funding of federal research, where these things can be millions or hundreds of millions or actually billions of dollars for higher education broadly. We want to make sure that our lawmakers have the benefit of a full and clear knowledge on these things.
So what do you wear into the game on Saturday?
I have a livery that I wore during our national championship season, and I found that it worked well in 2014, and so I give it a chance to work well all the time.
I think anyone will notice you're reusing a...
I bought some things when we first arrived that I thought would be appropriate to wear to games, and we ended up winning championships. So I must have bought the right stuff.
Yeah, And who gets to sit with you in the fancy box on the game, the big game?
So Brenda and I are there.
Your spouse, right?
Yes, and there is the area where we sit is divided into three sections. So one section is current trustees. Another section is former trustees and elected officials, and so former electeds and trustees are there. And then generally with us, the people who sit closest to us change week by week, and they range from students who've been involved in something that's special. One of my favorites is we had a student who had done heroic activities and helped another student, and we had the two of them come up and spend time with us. That was great. We have other people who've been great supporters of the university who come and visit us, and then we have sometimes some of our elected officials and others will come and spend time, prominent alums, etc. So all. You know, lots of people who are great supporters of the Buckeyes.
Well, have fun. I haven't checked the weather report, but best wishes for a happy day.
We'll look forward to a happy day, yes.
That is Dr. Michael Drake. He's president of Ohio State University. that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.